Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This week, we bring you The Flight of Betsy Lane by Sarah Orne Jewett. Jewett was born into an old New England family in the coastal town of South Berwick, Maine. She published at the age of 19 in the Atlantic Monthly. As a local color writer, she often emphasized people and place over plot. She was praised by other writers, including William Dean Howells, who described Jewett as having an uncommon feeling for talk. I hear your people. Speaking in praise of her novel, The Country of the Pointed Firs, none other than the esteemed Henry James declared it a beautiful little quantum of achievement. Jewett established a close relationship with the writer Anne Fields and her husband James Thomas Fields, the publisher and editor of the Atlantic Monthly. When James died suddenly, Anne and Sarah began to live together in what was called a Boston marriage, a term used at the time to describe two women living together, independent of the financial support of men. And now, The Flight of Betsy Lane by Sarah Orne Jewett. One windy morning in May, three old women sat together near an open window in the shed chamber of Byfleet Poorhouse. The wind was from the northwest, but their window faced the southeast, and they were only visited by an occasional pleasant waft of fresh air. They were close together, knee to knee, picking over a bushel of beans, and commanding a view of the dandelion-starred green yard below and of the winding sandy road that led to the village 2 miles away. Some captive bees were scolding among the cobwebs of the rafters overhead or thumping against the upper panes of glass. Two calves were bawling from the barnyard, where some of the men were at work loading a dump cart and shouting as if everyone were deaf. There was a cheerful feeling of activity and even an air of comfort about the Byfleet Poorhouse. Almost everyone was possessed of a most interesting past, though there was less to be said about the future. The inmates were by no means distressed or unhappy. Many of them retired to the shelter only for the winter season and would go out presently, some to begin such work as they could still do, others to live in their own small houses. Old age had impoverished most of them by limiting their power of endurance. But far from lamenting the fact that they were town charges, they rather liked the change and excitement of a winter residence on the poor farm. There was a sharp-faced, hard-working young widow with 7 children who was an exception to the general level of society, because she deplored the change in her fortunes. The older women regarded her with suspicion and were apt to talk about her in moments like this when they happened to sit together at their work. The three bean pickers were dressed alike in stout brown ginghams checked by a white line, and all wore great faded aprons of blue drilling with sufficient pockets convenient to the right hand. Miss Peggy Bond was a very small, belligerent-looking person who wore a huge pair of steel-bowed spectacles, holding her sharp chin well up in air, as if to supplement an inadequate nose. She was more than half blind, but the spectacles seemed to face upward instead of square ahead, as if their wearer were always on the sharp lookout for birds. Miss Bond had suffered much personal damage from time to time because she never took heed where she planted her feet, and so was always tripping and stubbing her bruised way through the world. She had fallen down hatchways and cellarways and stepped composedly into deep ditches and pasture brooks. But she was proud of stating that she was upsighted, and so was her father before her. At the poorhouse, where an unusual malady was considered a distinction, upsidedness was looked upon as a most honorable infirmity. Plain rheumatism, such as affected Aunt Lavina Dow, whose twisted hands found even this light work difficult and tiresome, plain rheumatism was something of everyday occurrence, and nobody cared to hear about it. Poor Peggy was a meek and friendly soul who never put herself forward. She was just like other folks, as she always loved to say. But Mrs. Lavina Dow was a different sort of person altogether, of great dignity, and occasionally almost aggressive behavior. The time had been when she could do a day's work with anybody, but for many years now she had not left the town farm, being too badly crippled to work. She had no relations or friends to visit, but from an innate love of authority she could not submit to being one of those who are forgotten by the world. Mrs. Dow was the hostess and social lawgiver here, where she remembered every inmate and every item of interest for nearly 40 years, besides an immense amount of town history and biography for 3 or 4 generations back. She was the dear friend of the third woman, Betsy Lane. Together they led thought and opinion, chiefly opinion, and held sway not only over Byfleet Poor Farm, but also the selectmen and others in authority. Betsy Lane had spent most of her life as an aide in general to the respected household of old General Thornton. She had been much trusted and valued, and at the breakup of that once large and flourishing family, she had been left in good circumstances, what with legacies and her own comfortable savings. But by sad misfortune and lavish generosity, everything had been scattered, and after much illness, which ended in a stiffened arm and more uncertainty, the good soul had sensibly decided that it was easier for the whole town to support her than for part of it. She had always hoped to see something of the world before she died. She came of an adventurous, seafaring stock, but had never made a longer journey than to the towns of Danby and Northville, 30 miles away. They were all old women, but Betsy Lane, who was 69 and looked much older, was the youngest. Peggy Bond was far on in the 70s, and Mrs. Dow was at least 10 years older. She made a great secret of her years, and as she sometimes spoke of events prior to the Revolution with the assertion of having been an eyewitness, she naturally wore an air of vast antiquity. Her tales were an inexpressible delight to Betsy Lane, who felt younger by 20 years because her friend and comrade was so unconscious of chronological limitations. The bushel basket of cranberry beans was within easy reach, and each of the pickers had filled her lap from it again and again. The shed chamber was not an unpleasant place in which to sit at work, with its traces of seed corn hanging from the brown cross beams, its spare churns and dusty loom, and rickety wool wheels and a few bits of old furniture. In one far corner was a wide board of dismal use and suggestion, and close beside it an old cradle. There was a battered chest of drawers where the keeper of the poorhouse kept his garden seeds, with the withered remains of 3 seed cucumbers ornamenting the top. Nothing beautiful could be discovered, nothing interesting, but there was something usable and homely about the place. It was the favorite and untroubled bower of the bean pickers, to which they might retreat unmolested from the public apartments of this rustic institution. Betsy Lane blew away the chaff from her handful of beans. The spring breeze blew the chaff back again and sifted it over her face and shoulders. She rubbed it out of her eyes impatiently and happened to notice old Peggy holding her own handful high as if it were an oblation and turning her queer up-tilted head this way and that to look at the beans sharply as if she were first cousin to a hen. "Oh, there, Miss Bond! 'Tis kind of botherin' work for you, ain't it?" Betsy inquired compassionately. "I feel to enjoy it. Anything that I can do my own way so," responded Peggy. "I like to do my part. Ain't that old Miss Fales coming up the road? It sounds like her steps." The others looked, but they were not far-sighted, and for a moment Peggy had the advantage. Mrs. Fales was not a favorite. "Oh, I hope she ain't coming here to put up this spring. I guess she won't now. It's getting so late," said Betsy Lane. "She likes to go roving soon as the roads is settled." "'Tis Miss Fales," said Peggy Bond, listening with solemn anxiety. "Oh, there, do let's pray her by." "I guess she's headed for her cousin's folk up Beech Hill way," said Betsy presently. "If she'd left her daughters this morning, she'd have got just about as far as this. I kind of wish she had stepped in just to pass the time of day. Long she wa'n't going to make no stop." There was a silence as to further speech in the shed chamber, and even the calves were quiet in the barnyard. The men had all gone away to the field where corn planting was going on. The beans clicked steadily into the wooden measure at the picker's feet. Betsy Lane began to sing a hymn and the others joined in as best they might, like autumnal crickets. Their voices were sharp and cracked, and now and then a few low notes of plaintive tone. Betsy herself could sing pretty well, but the others could only make a kind of accompaniment. Their voices ceased altogether at the high notes. "Oh, my! I wish I had the means to go to the Centennial!" mourned Betsy Lane, stopping so suddenly that the others had to go on croaking and shrilling without her for a moment before they could stop. "It seems to me as if I can't die happy less I do," she added. "I ain't never seen nothing of the world, and here I be."
"What if you was as old as I be?" suggested Mrs. Dow pompously. "You've got time enough yet, Betsy. Don't you go in despair. I knowed of a woman that went clean round the world 4 times when she was past 80 and enjoyed herself real well. Her folks followed the sea. She had 3 sons and a daughter married, all shipmasters, and she'd been with her own husband when they was young. She was left a widder early and fetched up her family herself. A real stirrin', smart woman. After they'd got married off and settled and was doing well, she come to be lonesome, and she first tried to stick it out alone, but she wa'n't one that could, and she got a notion she had nothing before her but her last sickness, and she wa'n't a person that enjoyed having other folks do for her. So one of her boys, I guess 'twas the oldest, said he was going to take her to sea. There was ample room, and he was sailing a good time of the year for the Cape of Good Hope and way up to some of them teaports in the Chiny Seas. She was all high to go, but it made a sight of talk at her age, and the minister made it a subject of prayer the last Sunday, and all the folks took a last leave. But she said to some she'd fetch him home something real purty, and so did. And then they come home t'other way, round the horn, and she done so well and was such a sight of company. The other chillen was jealous, and she promised she'd go a voyage long on each of 'em. She was as sprightly a person as I ever see, and could speak well of what she'd seen."
"Did she die at sea?" Peggy asked with interest.
"No, she died to home between voyages, or she'd gone to sea again. I was to her funeral. She liked her son George's ship the best. 'Twas the one she was going on to Caillou. They said the men aboard all called her grandmama, and she kept mended up and would go below and tend to 'em if they was sick. She might have been alive and enjoying of herself a good many years, but for the kick of a cow. 'Twas a new cow out of a drove, a dreadful, unruly beast."
Mrs. Dow stopped for breath and reached down for a new supply of beans. Her empty apron was gray with soft chaff. Betsy Lane, still pondering on the Centennial, began to sing another verse of her hymn, and again the old women joined in. At this moment, some strangers came driving round into the yard from the front of the house. The turf was soft, and our friends did not hear the horses' steps. Their voices cracked and quavered. It was a funny little concert, and a lady in an open carriage just below listened with sympathy and amusement.
"Betsy! Betsy! Miss Lane!" a voice called eagerly at the foot of the stairs that led up from the shed. "Betsy! There's a lady here wants to see you right away!"
Betsy was dazed with excitement, like a country child who knows the rare pleasure of being called out of school.
"Oh, Lord, I ain't fit to go down, be I?"
she faltered, looking anxiously at her friends. But Peggy was gazing even nearer to the zenith than usual in her excited effort to see down into the yard, and Mrs. Dow only nodded somewhat jealously and said that she guessed 'twas nobody would do her any harm. She rose ponderously while Betsy hesitated, being, as they would have said, all of a twitter.
"It's a lady, certain," Mrs. Dow assured her. "'Tain't often there's a lady come here."
"While there was any of Miss General Thornton's folks left, I went without visits from the gentry," said Betsy Lane, turning back proudly at the head of the stairs, with a touch of old-world pride and sense of high station.
Then she disappeared and closed the door behind her at the stair-foot with a decision quite unwelcome to the friends above.
"She needn't be so dreadful afraid anybody's going to listen.
I guess we've got folks to ride and see us, or had once, if we hain't now," said Miss Peggy Bond plaintively. "I expect 'twas only the wind shoved it too," said Aunt Lavina. "Betsy is one that gets flustered easier than some. I wish 'twas somebody to take her off and give her a kind of a good time. She's young to settle down long of old folks like us. Betsy's got a notion of roving such as ain't my nature, but I should like to see her satisfied. She'd been a very understanding person if she'd had the advantages that some does." "'Tis so," said Peggy Bond, tilting her chin high. "I suppose you can't hear nothing they're saying. I feel my hearing ain't up to where it was. I can hear things close to me well as ever, but their hearing ain't everything. 'Tain't as if we lived where there was any more going on to hear. Seems to me them folks is stopping a good while." "They surely be," agreed Lavina Dow. I expect it's something particular. There ain't none of the Thornton folks left, except one of the grain darters, and I've often heard Betsy remark that she should never see her more, for she lives in London. Strange how folks feels contented in them stray-away places off to the ends of the earth." The flies and bees were buzzing against the hot window panes. The handfuls of beans were clicking into the brown wooden measure. A bird came and perched on the windowsill, and then flitted away toward the blue sky. Below in the yard, Betsy Lane stood talking with the lady. She had put her blue drilling apron over her head, and her face was shining with delight. "Lord, dear," she said for at least a third time, "I remember you when I first see you. An awful pretty baby you was, and they all said you looked just like the old general. Be you going back to foreign parts right away?"
"Yes, I'm going back. You know that all my children are there. I wish I could take you with me for a visit," said the charming young guest. "I'm going to carry over some of the pictures and furniture from the old house. I didn't care half so much for them when I was younger as I do now. Perhaps next summer we shall all come over for a while. I should like you to see my girls and boys playing under the pines."
"I wish you really was living in the old place," said Betsy Lane. Her imagination was not swift. She needed time to think over all that was being told her, and she could not fancy the two strange houses across the sea. The old Thornton house was to her mind the most delightful and elegant in the world.
"Is there anything I can do for you?" asked Mrs. Strafford kindly. "Anything that I can do for you myself before I go away? I shall be writing to you and send in some pictures of the children, and you must let me know how you are getting on."
"Yes, there is one thing, darling. If you could stop in the village and pick me out a pretty little small looking glass that I can keep for my own and have to remember you by. 'Tain't that I want to set me above the rest of the folks, but I was always used to having my own when I was to your grandma's. There's very nice folk here, some on 'em, and I'm better off than if I was able to keep house. But since you ask me, that's the only thing I feel cropping about. What be you going right back for? Ain't you going to see the great fair to Philadelphy that everybody's talking about?"
"No," said Mrs. Strafford, laughing at this eager and almost convicting question. "No, I'm going back next week. If I were, I believe I should take you with me. Goodbye, dear old Betsy. You make me feel as if I were a little girl again. You look just the same." For a full 5 minutes, the old woman stood out in the sunshine, dazed with delight and majestic with a sense of her own consequence. She held something tight in her hand, without thinking what it might be. But just as the friendly mistress of the poorhouse came out to hear the news, she tucked the roll of money into the bosom of her brown gingham dress.
"'Twas my dear Miss Katie Strafford," she turned to say proudly. "She come way over from London. She's been sick. They thought the voyage would do her good. She said most the first thing she had on her mind was to come and find me and see how I was, and if I was comfortable. And now she's going right back. She's got two splendid houses, and said how she wished I was there to look after things. She remembered I was always her grandma's right hand. Oh, it does so carry me back to see her. Seems as if all the rest on 'em must be there together to the old house. There, I must go right up and tell Miss Dow and Peggy.
Dinner's all ready. I was just going to blow the horn for the menfolk, said the keeper's wife. They'll be right down.
I expect you got along smart with them beans, all three of you together.
But Betsy's mind roved so high and so far at that moment that no achievements of bean picking could lure it back.
The long table in the great kitchen soon gathered its company of waifs and strays, creatures of improvidence and misfortune, and the irreparable victims of old age. The dinner was satisfactory, and there was not much delay for conversation. Peggy Bond and Mrs. Dow and Betsy Lane always sat together at one end with an air of putting the rest of the company below the salt. Betsy was still flushed with excitement. In fact, she could not eat as much as usual, and she looked up from time to time expectantly, as if she were likely to be asked to speak of her guest. But everybody was hungry, and even Mrs. Dow broke in upon some attempted confidences by asking inopportunely for a second potato. There were nearly 20 at the table, counting the keeper and his wife and two children, noisy little persons who had come from school with the small flock belonging to the poor widow who just sat opposite our friends. She finished her dinner before anyone else and pushed her chair back. She always helped with the housework. A thin, sorry, bad-tempered-looking poor soul whom grief had sharpened instead of softened.
"I expect you feel too fine to set with common folks," she said enviously to Betsy.
"Here I be a settin'," responded Betsy calmly. "I don't know's I behave more unbecomin' than usual."
Betsy prided herself upon her good and proper manners, but the rest of the company, who would have liked to hear the bit of morning news, were now defrauded of that pleasure. The wrong note had been struck. There was a silence after the clatter of knives and plates, and one by one the cheerful town charges disappeared. The bean picking had been finished, and there was a call for any of the women who felt like planting corn. So Peggy Bond, who could follow the line of hills pretty fairly, and Betsy herself, who was still equal to anybody at that work, and Mrs. Dow, all went out to the field together. Aunt Lavina labored slowly up the yard, carrying a light, splint-bottomed kitchen chair and her knitting work, and sat near the stone wall on a gentle rise, where she could see the pond and the green country, and exchange a word with her friends as they came and went up and down the rows. Betsy vouchsafed a word now and then about Mrs. Strafford, but you would have thought that she had been suddenly elevated to Mrs. Strafford's own cares and the responsibilities attending them, and had little in common with her old associates. Mrs. Dow and Peggy knew well that these high-feeling times never lasted long, and so they waited with as much patience as they could muster. They were by no means without that true tact, which is only another word for unselfish sympathy. The strip of cornland ran along the side of a great field. At the upper end of it was a field corner thicket of young maples and walnut saplings, the children of a great nut tree that marked the boundary. Once, when Betsy Lane found herself alone near this shelter at the end of her row, the other planters having lagged behind beyond the rising ground, she looked stealthily about, and then put her hand inside her gown, and for the first time took out the money that Mrs. Strafford had given her. She turned it over and over with an astonished look. There were new bank bills for $100. Betsy gave a funny little shrug of her shoulders, came out of the bushes, and took a step or two on the narrow edge of turf, as if she were going to dance. Then she hastily tucked away her treasure and stepped discreetly down into the soft, harrowed and hoed land and began to drop corn again, 5 kernels to a hill. She had seen the top of Peggy Bond's head over the knoll, and now Peggy herself came entirely into view, gazing upward to the skies and stumbling, more or less, but counting the corn by touch and twisting her head about anxiously to gain advantage over her uncertain vision. Betsy made a friendly, inarticulate little sound as they passed. She was thinking that somebody said once that Peggy's eyesight might be remedied if she could go to Boston to the hospital, but that was so remote and impossible an undertaking that no one had ever taken the first steps.
Betsy Lane's brown old face suddenly worked with excitement, but in a moment more she regained her usual firm expression and spoke carelessly to Peggy as she turned and came alongside. The high spring wind of the morning had quite fallen. It was a lovely May afternoon. The woods about the field to the northward were full of birds, and the young leaves scarcely hid the solemn shapes of a company of crows that patiently awaited the corn planting. Two of the men had finished their hoeing and were busy with the construction of a scarecrow. They knelt in the furrows, chuckling and looking over some forlorn, discarded garments. It was a time-honored custom to make the scarecrow resemble one of the poorhouse family, and this year they intended to have Mrs. Lavina Dow protect the field in effigy. Last year it was the counterfeit of Betsy Lane who stood on guard, with an easily recognizable quilted hood and the remains of a valued shawl that one of the calves had found airing on a fence and chewed to pieces. Behind the men was the foundation for this rustic attempt at statuary, an upright stake and bar in the form of a cross. This stood on the highest part of the field, and as the men knelt near it, and the quaint figures of the corn planters went and came, the scene gave a curious suggestion of foreign life. It was not like New England. The presence of the rude cross appealed strangely to the imagination. Life flowed so smoothly, for the most part, at the Byfleet Poor Farm that nobody knew what to make, later in the summer, of a strange disappearance. All the elder inmates were familiar with illness and death, and the poor pomp of a town pauper's funeral. The comings and goings and various misfortunes of those who composed this strange family, related only through its disasters, hardly served for the excitement and talk of a single day. Now that the June days were at their longest, the old people were sure to wake up earlier than ever. But one morning, to the astonishment of everyone, Betsy Lane's bed was empty. The sheets and blankets, which were her own and guarded with jealous care, were carefully folded and placed on a chair not too near the window, and Betsy had flown. Nobody had heard her go down the creaking stairs. The kitchen door was unlocked, and the old watchdog lay on the step outside in the early sunshine, wagging his tail and looking wise, as if he were left on guard and meant to keep the fugitive's secret. "Never known her to do nothing afore, without thinking it over a fortnight, and parading off when we could all see her," ventured a spiteful voice. "Guess we can wait till night to hear about it." Mrs. Dow looked sorrowful and shook her head. "Betsy had an aunt on her mother's side that went and drowned it of herself. She was a pretty-appearing woman as ever you see."
"Perhaps she's gone to spend the day with Decker's folks," suggested Peggy Bond. "She always takes an extra early start. She was speaking lately of going up their way."
But Mrs. Dow shook her head with a most melancholy look.
"I'm impressed that something's befell her," she insisted. "I heard her a-groaning in her sleep. I was wakeful the fore part of the night. 'Tis very unusual with me, too."
"'Twa'n't like Betsy not to leave us any word," said the other old friend, with more resentment than melancholy.
They sat together almost in silence that morning in the shed chamber. Mrs. Dow was sorting and cutting rags, and Peggy braided them into long ropes to be made into mats at a later date. If they had only known where Betsy Lane had gone, they might have talked about it until dinner time at noon. But failing this subject, they could take no interest in any of their old ones. Out in the field, the corn was well up, and the men were hoeing. It was a hot morning in the shed chamber, and the woolen rags were dusty and hot to handle. Byfleet people knew each other well, and when this mysterious absent person did not return to the town farm at the end of the week, public interest became much excited, and presently it was ascertained that Betsy Lane was neither making a visit to her friends the Deckers on Birch Hill, nor to any nearer acquaintances. In fact, she had disappeared altogether from her wonted haunts. Nobody remembered to have seen her pass. Hers had been such an early flitting. And when somebody thought of her having gone away by train, he was laughed at for forgetting that the earliest morning train from South Byfleet, the nearest station, did not start until long after 8 o'clock, and if Betsy had been designed to one of those passengers, she would have started along the road at 7 and been seen and known of all women. There was not a kitchen in that part of Byfleet that did not have windows toward the road. Conversation rarely left the level of the neighborhood gossip. To see Betsy Lane in her best clothes at that hour in the morning would have been the signal for much exercise of imagination. And as day after day went without news, the curiosity of those who knew her best turned slowly into fear, and at last Peggy Bond again gave utterance to the belief that Betsy had gone out in the early morning and put an end to her life, or that she had gone to the Centennial. Some of the people at table were moved to loud laughter. It was at supper time on a Sunday night, but others listened with great interest. "She'd never put on her good clothes to drown herself," said the widow. "She might have thought 'twas as good as taking 'em with her, though. Old folks has wandered off and got lost in the woods afore now." Mrs. Dow and Peggy resented this impertinent remark, but deigned to take no notice of the speaker. "She wouldn't have wore her best clothes to Centennial, would she?" mildly inquired Peggy, bobbing her head toward the ceiling. "'Twould be a shame to spoil her best things in such a place. And I don't know of her having any money. There's the end of that."
"You're as bad as old Miss Bland. They used to live neighbor to our folks," said one of the old men. "She was dreadful precise, and she's so begretched to wear a good alapaca dress that was left to her that it hung in a press for 40 years and baited the moths at last."
"I often seen Miss Bland a-goin' to meetin' when I was a young girl," said Peggy Bond approvingly. "She was a good-appearin' woman, and she left property."
"Wish she'd left it to me, then," said the poor soul opposite, glancing at her pathetic row of children. But it was not good manners at the farm to deplore one's situation, and Mrs. Dow and Peggy only frowned.
"Where do you suppose Betsy can be?" said Mrs. Dow for the 20th time. "She didn't have no money. I know she ain't gone far, if it's so that she's yet alive. She's been real pinched all the spring."
"Perhaps that lady that come one day give her some," the keeper's wife suggested mildly.
"Well, then Betsy would have told me,"
said Mrs. Dow with injured dignity. On the morning of her disappearance, Betsy rose even before the peewee and the English sparrow and dressed herself quietly, though with trembling hands, and stole out of the kitchen door like a plunderless thief. The old dog licked her hand and looked at her anxiously. The tortoise-shell cat rubbed against her best gown and trotted away up the yard. Then she turned anxiously and came after the old woman, following faithfully until she had to be driven back. Betsy was used to long country excursions afoot. She dearly loved the early morning, and finding that there was no dew to trouble her, she began to follow pasture paths and shortcuts across the fields, surprising here and there a flock of sleepy sheep or a startled calf that rustled out from the bushes. The birds were pecking their breakfast from bush and turf, and hardly any of the wild inhabitants of that rural world were enough alarmed by her presence to do more than flutter away if they chanced to be in her path. She stepped along, light-footed and eager as a girl, dressed in her neat old straw bonnet and black gown, and carrying a few belongings in her best bundle handkerchief, one that her only brother had brought from the East Indies 50 years ago. There was an old crow perched as sentinel on a small dead pine tree, where he could warn friends who were pulling up the sprouted corn in a field close by, but he only gave a contemptuous caw as the adventurer appeared, and she shook her bundle at him in revenge, and laughed to see him so clumsy as he tried to keep his footing on the twigs.
"Yes, I be," she assured him. "I'm a-goin' to Philadelphy, to the Centennial, same's other folks. I'd just as soon tell you as not, old crow," said Betsy.
And Betsy laughed aloud in pleased content with herself and her daring as she walked along. She had only 2 miles to go to the station at South Byfleet, and she felt for the money now and then and found it safe enough. She took great pride in the success of her escape, and especially in the long concealment of her wealth. Not a night had passed since Mrs. Strafford's visit that she had not slept with the roll of money under her pillow by night and buttoned safe inside her dress by day. She knew that everybody would offer advice and even commands about the spending or saving of it, and she brooked no interference. The last mile of the footpath to South Byfleet was along the railway track, and Betsy began to feel in haste, though it was still nearly 2 hours to train time. She looked anxiously forward and back along the rails every few minutes for fear of being run over, and at last she caught sight of an engine that was apparently coming toward her, and took flight into the woods before she could gather courage to follow the path again. The freight train proved to be at a standstill, waiting at a turnout, and some of the men were straying about, eating their early breakfast comfortably in this time of leisure. As the old woman came up to them, she stopped, too, for a moment of rest and conversation. "Where be ye goin'?" she asked pleasantly, and they told her. It was to the town where she had to change cars and take the great through train, a point of geography which she had learned from evening talks between the men at the farm. "What'll ye carry me there for?"
"Oh, we don't run no passenger cars," said one of the young fellows, laughing. "What makes you in such a hurry?"
"I'm starting for Philadelphy, and it's a great ways to go."
"And so 'tis. But you're considerable early if you're making for the 8:40 train. See here, you haven't got a needle and thread long of you in that bundle, have you? If you'll sew me on a couple of buttons, I'll give you a free ride. I'm in a sight of distress, and none of the fellas is providing with as much as a bent pin."
"You poor boy! I'll have you seen to in half a minute. I'm troubled with a stiff arm, but I'll do the best I can."
The obliging Betsy seated herself stiffly on the slope of the embankment and found her thread and needle with utmost haste. Two of the trainmen stood by and watched the careful stitches, and even offered her a place as spare brakeman so that they might keep her near. And Betsy took the offer with considerable seriousness, only thinking it necessary to assure them that she was getting most too old to be out in all weathers. An express went by like an earthquake, and she was presently hoisted on board an empty boxcar by two of her new and flattering acquaintances. She found herself before noon at the end of the first stage of her journey without having spent a cent, and furnished with any amount of thrifty advice. One of the young men, being compassionate of her unprotected state as a traveler, advised her to find out the widow of an uncle of his in Philadelphia, saying despairingly that he couldn't tell her just how to find the house. But Miss Betsy Lane said that she had an English tongue in her head and should be sure to find whatever she was looking for. This unexpected incident of the freight train was the reason why everybody about the South Byfleet station insisted that no such person had taken passage by the regular train that same morning, and why there were those who persuaded themselves that Miss Betsy Lane was probably lying at the bottom of the poor farm pond.
"Land sakes!" said Miss Betsy Lane, as she watched a Turkish person parading by in his red fez. "I call the centennial something like the Day of Judgment. I wish I was going to stop a month, but I dare say 'twould be the death of my poor old bones."
She was leaning against the barrier of a patent popcorn establishment, which had given her a sudden reminder of home and of the winter nights when the sharp-kerneled little red and yellow ears were brought out, and old Uncle F. Flanders sat by the kitchen stove and solemnly filled a great wooden chopping tray for the refreshment of the company. She had wandered and loitered and looked until her eyes and head had grown numb and unreceptive. But it is only unimaginative persons who can be really astonished. The imagination can always outrun the possible and actual sights and sounds of the world. And this plain old body from Byfleet rarely found anything rich and splendid enough to surprise her. She saw the wonders of the West and the splendors of the East with equal calmness and satisfaction. She had always known that there was an amazing world outside the boundaries of Byfleet. There was a piece of paper in her pocket on which was marked in her clumsy handwriting, "If Betsy Lane should meet with accident, notify selectmen of Byfleet." But having made this slight provision for the future, she had thrown herself boldly into the sea of strangers, and then,
had made the joyful discovery that friends were to be found at every turn. There was something delightfully companionable about Betsy. She had a way of suddenly looking up over her big spectacles with a reassuring and expectant smile, as if you were going to speak to her, and you generally did. She must have found out where hundreds of people came from, and whom they had left at home, and what they thought of the great show, as she sat on a bench to rest, or leaned over the railings where free luncheons were afforded by the makers of hot waffles and molasses candy and fried potatoes. There was not a night when she did not return to her lodgings with a pocket crammed with samples of spool cotton and nobody knows what. She had already collected small presents for almost everybody she knew at home, and she was such a pleasant, beaming old country body, so unmistakably appreciative and interested, that nobody ever thought of wishing that she would move on. Nearly all the busy people of the exhibition called her either Auntie or Grandma at once, and made little pleasures for her as best they could. She was a delightful contrast to the indifferent, stupid crowd that drifted along, with eyes fixed at the same level and seeing, even on that level, nothing for 50 feet at a time. "What be you making there, dear?" Betsy Lane would ask joyfully, and the most perfunctory guardian hastened to explain. She squandered money as she had never had the pleasure of doing before, and this hastened the day when she must return to Byfleet. She was always inquiring if there were any spectacle sellers at hand, and received occasional directions, but it was a difficult place for her to find her way about in, and the very last day of her stay arrived before she found an exhibitor of the desired sort, an oculist and instrument maker. "I called to get some specs for a friend that's upsighted," she gravely informed the salesman to his extreme amusement. "She's dreadful troubled, and jerks her head up like a hen a-drinkin'. She's got a blur a-growin' and spreadin', and sometimes she can see out to one side on it, and more times she can't." "Cataracts," said a middle-aged gentleman at her side, and Betsy Lane turned to regard him with approval and curiosity. "'Tis Miss Peggy Bond I was mentioning, of Byfleet Poor Farm," she explained. "I count on getting some glasses to relieve her trouble, if there's any to be found."
"Glasses won't do her any good," said the stranger. "Suppose you come and sit down on this bench and tell me all about it. First, where is Byfleet?"
And Betsy gave the directions at length.
"I thought so," said the surgeon. "How old is this friend of yours?"
Betsy cleared her throat decisively and smoothed her gown over her knees as if it were an apron. Then she turned to take a good look at her new acquaintance as they sat on the rustic bench together.
"Who you be, sir, I should like to know?" she asked in a friendly tone.
"My name's Dunster."
"I take it you're a doctor?"
continued Betsy, as if they had overtaken each other, walking from Byfleet to South Byfleet on a summer morning.
"I'm a doctor, part of one at least," said he. "I know more or less about eyes, and I spend my summers down on the shore at the mouth of your river. Some day I'll come up and look at this person. How old is she?"
"Oh, Peggy Bond is one that never tells her age. 'Tain't come quite up to where she'll begin to brag of it, you see," explained Betsy reluctantly. "But I know her to be nigh to 76, one way or t'other. Her and Mrs. Mary Ann Chick was same year's children, and Peggy knows I know it. And two or three times, when we've been in the burying ground where Mary Ann lays and has her dates right on her headstone, I couldn't bring Peggy to take no sort of notice. I will say she makes at times a convenience of being upsided. But there, I feel for her. Everybody does. It keeps her stubborn and tripping against everything, beaking and gazing up the way she has to."
"Yes, yes," said the doctor, whose eyes were twinkling. "I'll come and look after her, with your town doctor this summer, sometime in the last of July or first of August."
"Oh, you'll find occupation," said Betsy, not without an air of patronage. "Most of us to the Byfleet farm has got our ales, now I tell you. You ain't got no bitters that'll take a dozen years right off an old lady's shoulders."
The busy man smiled pleasantly and shook his head as he went away.
"Dunster," said Betty to herself. soberly committing the new name to her sound memory.
"Yes, I mustn't forget to speak of him to the doctor, as he directed. I don't know now as Peggy would valley herself quite so much accordin' to if she had her eyes fixed same as other folks. I expect there wouldn't be a smarter woman in town, though, if she'd had a proper chance. Now I've done what I set out to do for her, I do believe, and 'twant glasses neither. I'll get her a pretty little shawl with that money I laid aside. Peggy Bond ain't got a pretty shawl. I always wanted to have a real good time, and now I'm having it."
Two or three days later, two pathetic figures might have been crossing the slopes of the Poor Farm field towards the shores of Byfield Pond. It was early in the morning, and the stubble of the lately mown grass was wet with rain and hindering to old feet. Peggy Bond was more blundering and liable to stray in the wrong direction than usual. It was one of the days when she could hardly see at all. Aunt Lavina Dow was unusually clumsy of movement and stiff in the joints. She had not been so far from the house for 3 years. The morning breeze filled the gathers of her wide gingham skirt and aggravated the size of her unwieldy figure. She supported herself with a stick and trusted beside to the fragile support of Peggy's arm. They were talking together in whispers.
"Oh, my sakes!" exclaimed Peggy, moving her small head from side to side. "Hear you wheeze, Miss Dow! This must be the death of you. There, do go slow. You sit here on the hillside, and let me go try if I can see."
"It needs more sight than you've got,"
said Mrs. Dow, panting between the words.
"Oh, to think how spry I was in my young days, and here I be now, the full of the door, and all my complaints so aggravated by my size. 'Tis hard, 'tis hard. But I'm a-doing all this for poor Betsy's sake. I know they've all laughed, but I look to see her rising to the top of the pond this day. 'Tis just 9 days since she departed, and say what they may, I know she hove herself in running her family. Betsy had an aunt that done just so, and she ain't been like herself, a-broodin' and hivin' away alone. Nothing to say to you and me that was always such good company all together. Something sprung her mind. Now I tell you, Miss Bond."
"I feel to hope we shan't find her, I must say," faltered Peggy.
It was plain that Mrs. Dow was the captain of this doleful expedition.
"I guess she ain't never thought of drowning herself, Miss Dow. She's gone off a visitin' way over to the other side of South Byfleet. Some think she's gone to the Centennial even now."
"She hadn't no proper means, I tell you,"
wheezed Mrs. Dow indignantly.
"And if you prefer that others should find her floating to the top this day, instead of us that's her best friends, you can step back to the house."
They walked on in a grieved silence. Peggy Bond trembled with excitement, but her companion's firm grasp never wavered. And so they came to the narrow, graveling margin and stood still. Peggy tried in vain to see the glittering water and the pond lilies that starred it. She knew they must be there. Once, years ago, she had caught fleeting glimpses of them, and she never forgot what she had once seen. The clear blue sky overhead, the dark pine woods behind the pond, were all clearly pictured in her mind.
"Can't you see nothing?" she faltered.
"I believe I'm wuss'n upsided this day. I'm going to be blind."
"No,"
said Lavina Dow solemnly.
"No, there ain't nothing whatever, Peggy. I hope to mercy she ain't."
"Why, whoever expected to find you way out here?" exclaimed a brisk and cheerful voice. There stood Betsy Lane herself, close behind them, having just emerged from a thicket of alders that grew close by. She was following the short way homeward from the railroad.
"Why, what's the matter, Miss Dow? You ain't overdoing, be you? And Peggy's all of a flutter. What in the name of nature ails you?"
"Well, there ain't nothing the matter, as I knows on,"
responded the leader of this fruitless expedition.
"We only thought we'd take a stroll this pleasant morning,"
she added, with sublime self-possession.
"Where have you been, Betsy Lane?"
"To Philadelphia, ma'am," said Betsy, looking quite young and gay, and wearing a townish and unfamiliar air that upheld her words. "All ought to go that can. Why, you feels as if you'd been all round the world. I guess I've got enough to think of and tell you for the rest of my days. I've always wanted to go somewheres. I wish you'd been there, I do so. I've talked with folks from Chiny and the back of Pennsylvania, and I see folks from Australia that appeared as well as anybody. And I seen how they made spool cotton and sights of other things. And I spoke with a doctor that lives down to the beach in the summer, and he offered to come up long in the 1st of August and see what he can do for Peggy's eyesight. There was diamonds there as big as pigeons' eggs, and I met with Miss Abby Fletcher from South Byfleet Depot, and there was hogs there that weighed rising 1,300. "I want to know," said Mrs. Levine Dow and Peggy Bond together.
"Well, 'twas a great experience for a person," added Lavina, turning ponderously in spite of herself, to give a last wistful look at the smiling waters of the pond.
"I don't know how soon I be going to settle down," proclaimed the rustic sister of Sinbad. "What's for the good of one's for the good of all. You just wait till we're sitting together up in the old shed chamber. You know, my dear Miss Caddy Stratford give me a handsome present of money that day she came to see me. And I'd been a-dreamin' by night and day, a-seein' that centennial, and when I come to think on it, I felt sure somebody ought to go from this neighborhood, if 'twas only for the good of the rest, and I thought I'd better be the one. I wa'n't goin' to ask the selectmen, neither. I've come back with 135 in money, and I see everything there, and I've fetched y'all a little something. But I'm full of dust now and pretty nigh beat out. I never see a place more friendly than Philadelphia. But 'tain't natural to be a Byfleet person to be always walking on a level. There now, Peggy, you take my bundle handkercher and the basket, and let Miss Dow sag onto me. I'll get her along twice as easy."
With this, the elderly company set forth triumphant toward the poorhouse, across the wide green field. And that's our story for this evening. I hope you enjoyed The Flight of Betsy Lane by Sarah Orne Jewett. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.